Welcome back to The Blueprint. Today, I'm super excited to have Hannah Kessler here. She's from the Money Multiplier. Now, she's second generation, which means she's been doing this stuff literally since she was eight. She's been active in the business since she was 18. She's had real estate since she's 20. So, we're gonna talk about infinite banking. Hannah, welcome, and let's get this thing unpacked.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me, Steve. And hello, hello to all the listeners.
Yes.
So,
So, yeah, please go ahead.
yeah, no. So, I can even just start by sharing like my journey of how I got in here, because probably some people are saying, oh my gosh, you are a young girl flapping your gums there. How do you know all this information? How'd you get here? So, actually, as of today, I'm 25 years old. I'll be 26 this year in the year of 2025. But, I've been around this stuff. I kind of make the joke since I've been pooping in my diapers because it was really my father who found this information. So actually, I grew up in the Kansas City area, and living in Kansas City, Pops was a chiropractor and he had five clinics in the Kansas City area. And it was back in 2006. He was going out to all of these chiropractic conventions and he was sitting in the audience. And there was a gentleman up there on stage teaching about this infinite banking concept. And Dad was sitting there in the audience. He sat there with his arms crossed like this. And he was like, man, that stuff looks really, really good, but it kind of just looks too good to be true. I mean, have you ever heard anything like that? Something too good to be true? So what Dad did is he bought Nelson's book, and I'll talk more about Nelson Nash here in a second. But he bought this black book, Becoming Your Own Banker. He went home, he set it on the shelf, and he didn't do anything with the information. So 2 years later, 2008, he was at that same chiropractic convention, and he was greeted by about 10 or 12 of his colleagues who were coming up to him, hooting and hollering about this banking concept. They're like, Brent, isn't this concept so cool? I'm able to pay off my debt, pay the salaries of my key employees, finance the adjustment tables in the office, and I'm all able to recycle and recapture that money back to myself. And so at that time, Dad was like, okay, there's no way 10 or 12 of my closest colleagues are lying to me right now. Maybe one or two of them, but no way 10 or 12. So that's when my family took action, was back in 2008. And back at that time, Mom and Pops almost had $1 million of debt. And actually, Dad's got it nailed down to the exact penny. But he had almost $1 million of debt. And by implementing this concept, he was able to pay that debt off in 39 months. So 3 years, 3 months, he didn't work any harder. He didn't see more patients, open the office longer hours. He just changed where the money was going first. And that's what this whole concept is about, because what do they teach us? They teach us to go out there, go get a good degree, go find a good J-O-B, max out your 401ks, and then let the government take care of you. I mean, but honestly, how well has that been working out to folks up to this point in our lives, right?
That's exactly right. That's what, when we met privately, we even got into a lot of just it no longer makes sense to just put your money in the bank. Like, who wants a return of 0.00002 or whatever it is today? So we get to stick up for ourselves, right, Hannah?
That's right. That's right. And on top of that, like the pennies that we get in our bank accounts, don't you got to pay tax on that money too? Isn't that kind of funny? And then what these bankers do is they take our money and they make a good living off of our money. Because, like, for instance, get this. Let's say I have this $20 bill here and I want this money to go sit and compound for myself because we've all been taught that compound interest is such a great thing. So, in order for compounding to work, we have to let our money, our product, our goods sit still somewhere. So if I want this $20 bill to go and compound, I'm going to walk into the bank and say, "Hey, Mr. Banker, here's my 20 bucks." And then it's sitting there, it's compounding. But if I go back in like a year, a week, a day, and I withdraw that $20 out, I've stopped the compounding on that money. But motion is a natural law of God, is it not? I mean, everything in life is about motion. I was flying earlier this week. You know, I ate breakfast this morning. My food's gonna be in motion in me soon. I mean, honestly, who wants to eat fish out of a stagnant pond? I don't. And so compounding stops that motion. And the thing I normally like to ask my audience, like when I travel all around the country and I teach on this concept, I ask them, I say, hey, name me one business in the world that actually uses compound interest. And Steve, I'll ask you, what one business uses compound interest? What's the business that you're thinking of?
It's always financial.
Banks. Hannah, banks use compound interest. Well, let's talk about that. Do they use compound interest? No, they pay you compound interest and they charge you compound interest, but they're not using it themselves. And here's what I mean by that. If I take this $20 bill and I highlight it and I put my initials on it and I take it down to the bank and I say, hey, Mr. Banker, here's my 20 bucks. Do you think there's a little black box in the back that says Hannah Kessler and they put my $20 bill in there and they wait until I come back and retrieve it? No, because if I go back in a day or a few hours and I want my $20 bill back, they're not going to give me the same one that I highlighted and I put my initials on. Because banks are in the lending business, they're moving the money. They take our money, they lend it out to you or to other people, and they're using our money and making a good living off of our money. So all I'm saying is that isn't it a little strange that these big major institutes like banks, Wall Street, mutual funds, they all tell us to park our money there with them, but they're not doing it themselves. A little strange. I just want people to get to see what's going on.
That's exactly right.
So think about it too, you know, because I am a real estate investor. That's what I like to do in my investment lifestyle. Because I never teach my people how to go make their money, how to go invest their money. I mean, yeah, if y'all want to have those buddy-buddy conversations, we can talk about it and I'll tell you what I'm doing, what's working out for me. But like, think about it. If tenants aren't moving in and out of property, how much do I make in the real estate business? Zero. If cars, like if I'm in the car salesman world, and if my cars aren't moving on and off the lots, how much money am I making? Nada. Even the grocery store business, if like the fresh produce is just sitting there on the shelves, rotting and compounding, I'm not making any money. So we need to really take our money to go and make it work for us. And that's what we say in the Kessler family. Your dollars are your little green men. And the objective is go put the little green men to work for you, create an army of green men that are out there working, so then I can take my time freedom, my location freedom back, so that if I wake up one Wednesday morning and I'm like, hey, I don't want to do any strategy calls today. I want to go sit my butt on the boat on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm going to go and do it, right?
That's exactly right. So let's get into the nitty-gritty. How does it work? Why does it work?
So, what the infinite banking concept truly is, and even before I dive deep into it, all of this information stems from this black book, Becoming Your Own Banker. So, I highly suggest everybody needs to add this to their wealth building library. You can go to my website, themoneymultiplier.com, purchase it from there. But to be honest with you, I'm not in the book selling business. So, go to Amazon, get it from there as well. And if you got a little ADD like myself, it comes with 2 hours of audio, okay? But all of this information that I teach comes from this black book, Becoming Your Own Banker. And high level, it's just taking back the control of the banking function in our life. Because Nelson Nash teaches us that you want to be in two businesses in your lifetime. The first business is the one that you're passionate about. Gets you up out of bed every day, supports the family, supports the lifestyle. But the second business is your banking business, the business that finances everything throughout your life. And that's what we're here talking about is that banking business. So with this, I don't keep my money stored in the local bank. I keep very little money stored in the bank. I haven't found a way to totally eliminate the conventional banks from my life. So, y'all listening, if you do know of a way, please tell me, call me up because I've been trying to find a way. But I store the majority of my wealth inside of a whole life insurance policy that is with a mutually owned insurance company. Now, the whole life policy, it needs to be designed specifically for this infinite banking concept. So what I mean by that is when I put a dollar or my premium deposit into that policy, I immediately, and my definition of immediately is within 30 days, I immediately have a cash value in there that I can take out the cash and then go and use it for whatever I want. I'm not limited to what I can use this cash value for. So I really want to put emphasis that it needs to be designed specifically for this concept because we all probably have a brother-in-law that sells life insurance, and it's not that traditional life insurance they can go and buy off the shelf. It needs to be designed for this concept. And a lot of people ask, well, hey, Hannah, why whole life? Because when I follow Dave Ramsey and Susie Orman, they tell me whole life insurance is the worst place to put my money. And I get it. I mean, that's why it took my family 2 years to start this stuff, because my dad was actually Dave Ramsey's baby step follower. But, why whole life? Why do we want to use whole life? And again, when I travel around and I teach on this, I get a lot of good responses back from the audience. But the number one reason of why we use whole life is this is what the elite and the wealthy are doing. I mean, the number one purchasers of whole life insurance in the world are conventional banks. And matter of fact, since 2013, banks have even quadrupled in their portfolio of how much whole life insurance they actually own. And so it's like, okay, are these banks stupid or are they doing something the rest of us just don't know about? They're probably doing something. And y'all, I want you to go fact check me on this stuff. If you go out there and you Google BOLI, BOLI, it stands for Bank Owned Life Insurance. And you can look up the hundreds of pages that come up of how much whole life insurance these banks actually own. So I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. I'm just going to mimic and imitate what these elite and wealthy folks have been doing for decades and decades.
Yeah. When you look at the numbers, because I've Googled just like what you're saying, you pull it up and the numbers are staggering. JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, B of A, like all the big boys, the numbers are in, billions and billions of dollars
That's right.
that are in whole life insurance policies.
That's right. It, and
Yeah.
it's listed right underneath their tier one assets. Because you'll notice number one, it says cash on hand. And then right underneath of that, it says cash value life insurance. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So from there, all right, so now we understand what the vehicle is. It's a whole life insurance policy with a mutually owned insurance company that pays dividends. And again, it's got to be designed specifically for this infinite banking concept. And how you know it's designed correctly is when you put a dollar into the policy, that premium deposit. Okay. And here's where the paradigm shift starts to happen with this stuff. I look at my premiums as they are deposits because when I put money into an account that I own, I control. That to me is treated more as a deposit rather than a payment. And I mean, what word y'all like better, payment or deposit, right? So, how you know it's designed correctly is when you put this premium deposit into that policy, you immediately, within 30 days, have access to the cash value that's now inside of there. So, to even just get more specific of like, okay, well, why do you run your money through the policy? There's all these other vehicles that are out there. Why are we doing this? Honestly, if I have my investor glasses on, this is not the only reason we do this, but one of my favorite reasons is when that money flows through the policy or it hits my policy first, now starts the time clock of the uninterrupted compounding interest that I'm able to earn on that money for the rest of my life. So what I mean by that is, let's say that I put money inside of this policy, and let's just make believe that I have a $25,000 cash value. I'm just making up numbers. And let's say that I want to go purchase myself a $25,000 car. Well, when I take money out of this policy, I'm not withdrawing the money. I'm taking out a policy loan, and that's big. Because most people, when they go and pay cash for things, people love paying cash for stuff. They think when they pay cash for things, they don't have to pay any payments and they don't have to pay any interest. But honestly, that's not the truth. Because if you just have like $25,000 that's just sitting inside of your traditional checking or savings account at the bank and you withdraw it out to go pay cash for that car, okay, you've accomplished the goal of buying the car, but that $25,000 is gone. It's left your hands, it's left your family forever. And so, in order to get that $25,000 back inside of your pocket, earning you interest again, you got to go work for it. You got to go earn it somehow. So that's why we just add the additional step of running the money through the policy first, and then I'll go take it out to go purchase the car. Because I am not withdrawing the money, I'm taking out a policy loan. So what that means is I'm putting my policy, my death benefit up for collateral, and I'm taking a loan from the general funds of the insurance company. So I'm using their money out here in the real world, and that's how and why my 25 grand still sits in the policy to grow and compound as if it wasn't even touched. And I don't know any other vehicle on the planet that actually does this stuff.
Yeah, I'm not aware of one.
If you
Now,
know of one, please tell me.
yeah, exactly. Let's talk about benchmarks for a second. So we're putting our premium deposits in, right? From your experience as far as benchmarks, what's the most we can stack in? What's the least? Pros and cons.
That's the cool thing about this too. I'm glad that you asked that question because you get to decide how much you want to put into your policy. If you're ever talking with anybody who is telling you how much to put in my opinion, run the total opposite direction, okay? Because you are in control of this. You get to decide how much you want to put in. I started my first policy $400 a month when I was 18 years old, because you got to be 18 in order to own a policy. So at that time when I turned 18, dad called me up and he says, okay, Hannah, now that you're 18, you're going to close your savings account and you're going to start your first policy. And back at that time, I was actually still a waitress at Cracker Barrel. I loved that gig. That was so much fun. But I was waitressing and I was saving up about $100 a week. So dad says, okay, you're saving 100 a week. That's 400 a month. And that's where you're going to start with your first policy as those premiums that are going in. But to answer your question, I would say minimum, use the 10 times the age rule. So if I had an individual, let's say they're 45 years old, take your age, multiply it by 10. So $450 on a monthly premium, that's what I would suggest as the minimum to design the policy properly for this banking concept. So 10 times the age. And honestly, though, I got folks who do as little as $100 a month, all the way up to $540,000 a month. So you just pick a number that's comfortable and in between there.
Got it. Now you mentioned the minimum age requirement. Now, is there any way to bring in a younger individual via trust or any other vehicle, or is 18 the hard cold truth?
So you got to be 18 in order to own it, but you can always put a policy on a child. That's what my dad did. You know, when I was younger, he would own the policy. I was the insured person, so the death benefit was on me. And then there's the beneficiary of the policy, the one who receives the death benefit payout when the insured person passes. And dad would name himself as that beneficiary. So he was the owner, I was the insured person, he was the beneficiary. And the owner is the one who has total control and is responsible for that policy. And loans are made payable to that owner. So, people who have children, y'all can put the policies on your children, even employees. We don't have to go down this deep rabbit hole right now, but hey, in the chiropractic office and even here at the Money Multiplier, we don't have our folks open up 401ks, HSAs, and all of those other qualified IRA vehicles. We really use the policies. So, we as the employer, we own the policy. They're the insured person. And then we actually give them somebody who they want to name as the beneficiary on that policy. And we kind of even split up that beneficiary. So the only minimum here is just in order to own it, you do have to be 18 years old, but you could use a trust, you know, a business or a parent, a guardian who is over the age of 18, they can own it and they can still practice this concept, even though that individual is a minor.
Got it. So what's the transition or transfer look like? Is it a new policy, or can a minor policy transfer into a 18 plus type policy?
They can, it can. So the only things that can change on the policy is the owner and the beneficiary. The insured person on that policy can never change. So in the future, you can give that ownership over to your child. And it's very simple. It's just a one-page document. It's just the ownership change form. And you don't have to go through any underwriter approval to have that happen. But you just fill out that one-page form, you get the wet signatures on it, send it into the insurance company, and they make that update on it. Honestly, right now, my dad owns quite a few policies on me. I got two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother. He is still the owner of those policies because he's using it. He wants these vehicles and he's using the cash values. And I doubt he'll give me the ownership of those policies until he's like on his deathbed and I have to like pick up the pen. I say, okay, dad, sign your name right here. Give me the ownership now.
Now, is there with dynamics like that? So you have your own policy. Your dad may still have a policy on you and your brothers. Is there a threshold where can the companies, competing companies, see how many policies are out there? What's that look like as far as jumping into the game?
Yes, no, good question. They can because how the insurance companies look at all of this is they are always looking at it from a death benefit perspective. Where I know us over here, we're always looking at it from how much cash and how much premium can I stick into this thing. And actually, that's a good point that we should even talk about too, because these policies, they're reverse engineered. I know when most insurance people that you're talking to, they're always asking you, hey, how much death benefit do you want? And I'm going to go out there and find you the cheapest premium for that death benefit. I don't care about the death benefit. Death benefit's just the cherry on top of the cake, and it's going to be on the policy whether you like it or not. So when we go in and we design the policies, I'm always asking you how much cash, how much premium do you want to deposit into that policy? And we allocate those dollars building it for high immediate cash value. And then that just pops us out X amount of death benefit of whatever that buys us. So it's just like in the car insurance world, you know how you can't overinsure a car? You can't overinsure a body. You can't go get Ferrari insurance on like a 2006 Honda Civic, you know? So it's the same thing in the life insurance world. Based on you, your age, your health, social history. Are you a smoker? Are you a drinker? Do you have 7 DUIs in the last 3 years? You know, the insurance companies are going to look at that. They're going to look at your financial life, your income, your net worth. And based off of that, they essentially put a dollar amount on your life. And it sounds kind of crappy when I put it that way, but that's what they're doing. And so, based on everybody, people have different death benefits that they can go up and qualify for. But here's the thing. Hopefully, as time goes on, we're making more money, we're acquiring more assets, that my death benefit, or what's technically called my insurability, that will keep climbing year after year. And I've even noticed that in my own life. Like I have up to this point, I'm actually in underwriting for my eighth policy. I have 7 policies in underwriting for the eighth one right now. And they always ask me about those other policies that I have. And I tell them all the death benefits on it. And the cool thing is that as I've been evolving and growing as an adult, I'm making more money, and thus I can qualify for more and more death benefit as time goes on.
Understood. So is it always best to just keep stacking on new policies, or is there a tool to repackage an existing policy and bring it from, 2 million to 3, or like whatever the numbers are?
Yeah, no, good question. So here's the thing. In a policy that's already in force or established, you cannot just go into an existing policy and increase the premiums or technically increase the death benefit. However, you can't always lower them. So if I, for instance, like my first policy, $400 a month. If I ever had like a bad month and I'm like, oh my goodness, I don't have this $400, I can always go inside of that policy and reduce it, that premium, by 60%. So I can always go in there and lower the premiums, but I can't increase them. So for instance, you know, I was working my job at Cracker Barrel. I left that job and I started working in this business with Pops. Because actually, Dad called me up one day and he's like, "Hey, Hannah, I need help in the business. If you're not going to help me, I'll go find someone else." And I was like, "Okay, well, what do you want me to do?"
Yeah.
So that's where I started off as is actually doing the applications within the office, helping people get approved for their policies, working with these underwriters directly, and I was making more money than what I was waiting tables. And so I had that conversation with myself. I said, "All right. I know I'm putting in 400 a month right now, but I want to do 800 a month. Well, I can't just go into that existing policy and increase the premiums. So what I did is I opened up a second policy, another 400 a month. So then I had a total of 800 monthly cash flow that was going towards policy premiums. And think about it like it's almost like a branch office of your bank. Right? You can go to the Wells Fargo on Main Street. You can go to the Wells Fargo on 3rd Street. Doesn't matter. It's the same branch office. And that's the same thing with the policies. They're just your branch offices of your bank.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it for sure.
Yeah.
Nice. So, with your experience, what's the best strategies that you've seen as far as a two-part question, how people are using the policy and funds while they're alive? And then not to be morbid, but the death benefit, it's either used up or there's something at the end. So let's kind of look at that and figure out the best strategies that you've seen as those policies close out.
So I'm going to start there first. There is always going to be a death benefit left over at the end of the day. Your death benefit is always going to be higher than the cash that's inside of that policy. And a lot of people don't know this, but because these are mutually owned insurance companies, and what that means, so there's stock-held insurance companies and there's mutually owned insurance companies. We want mutually owned companies because when we are a policy owner with them, We share in the profits of that insurance company. We are mutual owners with them. So at the end of the year, when they pay out that dividend, because dividends now, and let me even back it up a second, we get a guaranteed interest inside of that policy contract. You get a guaranteed interest. And that's just not my flab and gum saying that. That's literally written inside of that policy contract itself. So you'll notice when you're looking at the policy, you have this guaranteed side that shows you year after year your cash values and your death benefit, but you also have this non-guaranteed column. And the non-guaranteed column is showing the dividends that get paid out. So I can't sit here and promise dividends inside of a policy contract because they're not contractually guaranteed. But with all of our six companies that we work with, they've been paying out dividends for over 120 plus consecutive years. My longest one being 148 consecutive years. And that's a whole other rabbit hole we can go down. That's what I talk about on my podcast show, the Money Multiplier Podcast. It's like, why are these insurance companies still paying out a surplus in dividends when times of total economic distress, like the 2008 Civil War, Great Depression, et cetera, et cetera? It gets pretty interesting when you start to peel back the onion, but we don't got to go there right now. So these dividends, when they get paid out to us, that goes back inside of our policy and it shows up as cash value, but it also buys us a little bit of death benefit year after year. So you'll notice every year the cash value keeps increasing, and so does your death benefit that keeps increasing as well. So there was always going to be a death benefit that gets paid out to your beneficiaries. And that gets paid out lump sum tax-free to that beneficiary. The only time that it actually equals is when you are age 121. So if you get to age 121, literally the insurance company just pays you out the death benefit and they're like, hey, it's been fun with you. We no longer want to play in the sandbox with you anymore. Here's your death benefit money, you know? So there's always going to be a death benefit there. But to answer that question of what are people really utilizing their policies for, my first suggestion would be if you have any of those bad debts, because as we know, not all debt is bad debt, but that's where I would start first, those bad debts, the non-cash flowing debts, like car loans, maybe student loans. Mortgages are kind of iffy. I have my opinions on them, but credit card debts, boat loans. I want to clear off any of those bad debts first. Start freeing up that monthly cash flow. And then now, once my bad debts are paid off, how do I really bridge that gap between the debt payoff to now wealth building? And that's what I would like to see people using their policies for is large expenses, their investments. That's where I see most of my people really thrive in this because now they're double dipping on that money. Here's what I mean. I'm in the lending business. That's what I like to do in real estate. So if I use my cash value in my policy, let's say you, Steve, you call me up and you're like, Hannah, I got this great deal. I'm about to do a fix and flip on this property and I need $50,000. Okay, Steve, I'll loan you $50,000. I take it from the cash value that's inside of my policy. Now, number one, I hold first position on that property. No ifs, ands, or buts. My dad has always taught me if you're not first, you're last. So I always hold that collateral of the first position. And because I'm the one who has the gold, I make the rules. So my rates right now are 12%. So, okay, Steve, I'm going to loan you this $50,000 and you're going to pay me back monthly interest checks and I'm going to charge you 12% on it. But why I use the money in the policy is because, reminder, I didn't withdraw the money out. I took out a policy loan. So my $50,000 is still remaining in the policy, earning me that guaranteed interest and dividends. And I'm making interest over here in the investment deal that I'm doing. So I just sum it up and I kind of say I'm double dipping on my money by doing so.
So at 12, what are the most what are you borrowing at on the policies? I'm just kind of running rough numbers so people realize what that arbitrage looks like, right?
Yes. So Interest rates on the policy are anywhere from 5 to 8%. I kind of stuttered on that for a second because let me tell you, contractually inside of the policy, it states in there that loan interest can be anywhere from 0 to 8%. Right now, within the insurance company industry, it's anywhere from 5 to 7% is within that realm. Something that's cool too that not a lot of people know, but these insurance companies aren't federally regulated. They are regulated at the state level. They are their own private entities, and they are the ones who get to determine how much they want to charge on their loan interest rate. And the loan interest rate, another powerful thing, this is a simple annual interest. And I need to probably talk about that a lot more than what I do. So I'm paying my policy loans on a simple annual 5% interest, and my policy growth is growing at a guaranteed 3%. And then if I incorporate my dividends, I mean, last year I saw an overall growth of 5.7% in all of my policies. So I'm earning a uninterrupted compounding five, we'll call it, and I'm paying my loan interest at a 5% simple annual interest, which is pretty powerful.
Yeah. Just to stress the fact again, there is no other vehicle where you get to double dip, that money is earning and you get to use the money at the same time. It's incredibly powerful. And I really want to drive that home about the fact that there, just to reiterate, there is no other vehicle that gives you that ability.
That's right. That's
Because
right.
I've been looking.
And it goes back to, okay, not to get cheesy, but there's a man by the name of Albert Einstein. And here's what Albert Einstein says. He says, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. And those who understand it earn it, and those who don't pay it. And it's like, okay, what have we been doing all these years paying out this loan interest or this compounding interest, I should say, to all of these banks and other financial institutions? Now that I know what they're doing, I'm just going to mimic and play the game right along there with them. And the thing is, this stuff is not on trial. I mean, whole life insurance has been around longer than our tax code's even been here. The tax code's only been here since 1913. And in my opinion, I think we're better off without it because there was actually a surplus in our economy, but that's a whole other rabbit hole we don't have to go down right now. But you know, people put so much money inside of these vehicles that are not time and true tested. Did you know the inventor of the 401k, his name is Ted Benna? Ted Benna came out with the 401k in 1978. Think about that. That was 1978. And people who are maxing out like their IRA accounts, do you know the IRA came about in the late 80s? And it's just funny to me how society, we have taken these vehicles and we're putting all of our retirement money, our energy, our dollars into this thing. And we're just kind of crossing our fingers and thinking, hey, I hope in the future the money's going to be there when I need it. Right?
That's exactly right. Not only that, the reading that I did, the 401k wasn't even supposed to be a long-term vehicle. It was supposed to be like a temporary holding or something. Like, don't quote me, but that's what I recall when I was reading that. Hey, I want to get back to the death benefit just for a second, because you hear buzzwords like Rockefeller method or waterfall method and all this stuff. And I want people to understand that that money can be handed down indefinitely.
Right.
And that's that death benefit. If it's not, if it's substantial, it's a big lump sum to start a new policy over for a 18-year-old, for a minor, for whomever.
That's right. And I like that you are bringing up death benefit because people in this concept, they love to emphasize the cash in it. But the death benefit is very, very important because that's where the generational wealth and the legacy aspect of this concept comes into play. It honestly mind boggles me that people will go out there and spend buku bucks on insurance that's all if this happens. Flood insurance, fire insurance. Yeah, I get there's some things that we have to have, like car insurance, but people will spend so much money on those if insurance, but then they neglect the insurance that's actually guaranteed to happen. I hate to break it to y'all, but you're gonna pass. Or graduate is what I like to say. You are guaranteed to graduate at some point in your life. You have an expiration date. And so when that time comes, that death benefit is going to get paid out lump sum tax-free to that beneficiary. And so to your point, like the Rockefeller method, and that's it, because all these like big wealthy families, Rockefellers, Rothschilds, Morgan Stanleys, Barclays, they all understood money and how to keep the money within the family. And so what they would do is they would set up trust to own the policy, be the beneficiary of the policy. They would get the policies on all the family members, max them all out. And so what would happen is the trust would be the one, almost like the family bank. Okay. So when people needed money to go buy houses, cars, livestock, whatever it is, the trust would be the family bank. And so the family members would pull from the family bank. Now, here's number two. Pay yourself back and pay yourself back with interest. If you are going to practice this concept, be an honest banker with yourself. Do you have to pay back your policy loans? No, but treat your money just how you treat the bank's money. If you don't, you're just saying that the banker's money is not as valuable as your money, and that's not the truth. So play honest banker. If you're going to pull from the family bank, pay yourself back and charge yourself interest. So at the end of it, let's say that that family member was financing and using the family bank to purchase assets, whatever, during their lifetime. So at the end, when that individual passes, that death benefit now gets paid to the trust. So the trust then, they'll just rinse and repeat that process. They'll take that money, they'll go through, max out more and more policies on new or existing family members, and the whole cycle just keeps going. And that's why these families were able to keep money inside of their family instead of like the Vanderbilts, who didn't understand it and they totally diminished all of their wealth in like what, 3 or 4 generations. I don't want to do that, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The legacy part for me is huge, and it's one of those funny things that we kind of deny the fact that we have an expiration date until it gets really, really, really close. So I think the pre-planning, understanding that all your hard work can be handed down generation after generation is real. This is the vehicle to do it. I do have one last question. I know we're pushing our time constraints a little bit, but when you're putting a minor into a policy, how are they being evaluated? Are they being evaluated off of your net worth? Like, how do you get a monster policy on a 2-year-old?
Yeah, good question. So for children, it's based on juvenile guidelines where they can have half of the amount of death benefit that mom and dad have on their bodies. So that's what the insurance companies are always looking at. If you, for instance, Steve, if you don't have any death benefit on your body and then you try to go after your children and totally max them out, the insurance companies are going to kind of scratch their head and say, well, hey, aren't your children financially dependent on you? They're the ones who are going to need the death benefit in the event of your premature passing. So my biggest advice is start with the matriarch and the patriarch of the family first. I'm not saying that you can't do the entire family at the same time, but if I had a preference, start with mom and dad first and then go to the downline of the children. Because mom and dad, as history has it, they're supposed to pass before the children. And right, that's where the legacy and the generational wealth comes into play. So for the children, and this is only for minors up to the age of 18, or I should even say non-dependence. I know there's that funky little gray area where folks are still going to college, right? And they could still be dependents. They will still be based on those juvenile guidelines. But let's say that you have $1 million of death benefit on your body. Well, your child can qualify up to 500,000 in death benefit on them. And that's how you can get it on the children.
Got it. Nice. Okay. Well, we covered a lot.
I
Is
got one more for you.
well, that's what I was asking. Is there any other key points? Is there highlights? Is there a spotlight that you need to shine before we sign off?
This is just my gift to everybody listening.
Yeah.
If you send me an email, Hannah spelled the same ways forwards and backwards, Hannah at themoneymultiplier.com. I will send you a copy of our ebook, Mapping Out the Millionaire Mystery. So this is actually a book that my father and also Chris Noggle wrote together. If y'all don't know Chris Noggle, I would highly recommend go follow him on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook. He's always posting out content out there. Noggle is spelled N-A-U-G-L-E. But send me an email and I'll send you a copy of this ebook, Mapping Out the Millionaire Mystery. It's almost a spin-off of Nelson Nash's teachings, Becoming Your Own Banker. But if I had to recommend one, go get Nelson's book first and then read this one.
Nice.
So thank you, man. Thanks for
So,
having me.
hey, we can find you at the Money Multiplier. Where else can we find you? Are you out and about? You guys are doing events. Where can we find you? What's going on?
So the Money Multiplier is a great place. I also have my podcast show, The Money Multiplier Podcast. And then you can also follow me. I've been doing a lot of TV interviews, traveling all around the country doing that. So if you go to my website, hannahkessler.com, Hannah spelled the same ways forwards and backwards, Kessler with one S, and you can keep up to date on where I'm at all around the country. And I'd love to see you in person. That's my favorite thing. I love that live events are up and about. I'll tell you, COVID times sucked because everything went to virtual, but now everything's back and live. And I'm like, I love it. I love feeling the energy in the room.
Yeah, being one-on-one live is a whole different deal. Like these are great and they're convenient and we get things facilitated, but it is a whole different deal when you're one-on-one in person. So, and I appreciate you being here. You dropped some nuggets for sure. To have it simply explained like that, because there is so much confusion about where do I get the policy? What can it be any part? Like all the stuff that you went through, it's incredibly helpful. So we appreciate you. Once again, thanks for being here, everybody. Hannah Kessler.
Thank you, Steve. Catch y'all
Yeah,
soon.
absolutely. Take care, everybody.